Hi, and welcome to Power of 10, a podcast about design operating at many levels, zooming out from thoughtful detail through to organizational transformation and on to changes in society and the world. My name is Andy Pullane. I'm a service design and innovation consultant, design leadership coach, educator, and writer. My guest today is Cheryl Kababa, author of Closing the Loop, Systems Thinking for Designers. She's a design researcher and strategist and is the chief strategy officer at Substantial, a research, insights, and development studio based in Seattle. Her practice is focused on systems thinking and equity-centered design, and she's worked with a diverse base of clients, including the Gates Foundation, Microsoft, IKEA, and Khan Academy. Her focus is on using design to help clients reimagine education. If that wasn't enough, she also teaches at the University of Washington's Human-Centered Design and Engineering Program, helping to introduce systems thinking to the next generation of designers. Cheryl, welcome to Power of 10.
Thank you. So happy to be having this conversation.
So of all people who should be on this podcast, it's you, because the systems thinking thing is all about those different kind of layers of Zoom. Before we do, let's kind of zoom back to you. And I'm always interested in how people's journey to here. So what was your journey? What did you start out doing or think you were going to do? And now where are you?
Yeah, I really thought that I was going to be a product designer forever. I started out the first half of my career, you know, primarily doing digital product design. I worked at Microsoft. I worked at Philips Design. What's funny is, before that, I thought I was going to be a journalist. And so I studied journalism and political science when I was in school. And I think it's interesting. Like, I sort of, halfway through my career as it sort of stands today, I kind of entered the world of design strategy and research when I became a design consultant. You know, I started working for AdaptiPath, was like the first consultancy I worked for. And I loved kind of like their approach to design in terms of, you know, everybody was kind of a generalist. We had like researchers and strategists and also experienced designers. But you kind of had to know how to do all of it. And I really gravitated towards research and strategy because it felt a little bit like, I don't know, I was a little bit of like a disgruntled product designer by that point, because I felt like a lot of the decisions had already been made before they get to where I am. And I am here kind of like designing screens and, you know, didn't feel like that empowered to like actually question what came before, before me in terms of like the decisions that were made. And so, being able to be at the front end of the design process, particularly when you're engaging in design strategy, really appealed to me. And it's funny because I know a lot of designers who are kind of like, oh, does it bother you that do you ever feel like you don't see anything out in the world that
you don't
like
make
you had
anything
actually
anymore.
Worked on? Yeah, I don't make anything anymore. And I'm like, no, I'm actually really like where I'm at. And I think there is actually something really interesting, for example, in terms of working on a product or a strategy that never comes to fruition, and trying to understand why that is just as interesting as when I see it come to fruition and it's not exactly reflected in kind of like the work we initially did. And so I think working in that space and working with like a ton of just different organizations in different domains, you naturally, I think, many in that same position gravitate towards ideas that align with systems thinking methodology, because, you know, you're kind of like considering the intersection of organizations, products and services, and end users and other stakeholders who are kind of engaged at the eventual use of those products and services. You know, around this time, I was actually doing a lot of like service design as well. So I think all of those things combined got me really interested in system thinking methodology. And I think that's where that's how I started trying to integrate it into my practice. And you kind of see the results of that effort, like successful or not, in the book.
It is successful. I'm really pleased. I was just saying before, you know, before we started recording, I particularly want to give it to, well, no, I want all my students to buy it. I really think it's an important thing. So I'm going to get onto it in a second. But when you were saying, you know, I was this frustrated product designer and then got into all of this, when are we talking here? Sort of what year are we talking?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like I moved to the States in 2015 from the Netherlands. And so like I was kind of experiencing, you know, myself and my family experiencing kind of like a big shift in kind of like moving back home to the US.
Yeah.
And like, I think around that time I was doing a lot of work with sort of like kind of big sort of like enterprise organizations. Mm. Like I worked with kind of like a major Canadian bank. I worked with a big pharmaceutical company. And I was a design consultant at Artifact at the time, which is another sort of Seattle-based studio. And I think kind of working on those kinds of products and services, you just start realizing that it's, I don't know, these things are intertwined. And then kind of the things that were happening in the world at that time, like the US election, Brexit, you're just kind of like, oh, these things are really, like everything is connected in a way that we don't always acknowledge as we're making decisions about it. Yeah. And so just kind of like the political environment we were in at that time, combined with like kind of these big projects that I was working on, just got me really interested in just kind of thinking specifically about causality, about unintended consequences. And this really jumped out when I was working with kind of big technology companies on emerging technology was, you know, like I kind of kick off the book with an anecdote about like how I used Black Mirror as an example to encourage my clients to think about unintended consequences. And they actually kind of viewed it as potential feature ideas. And that was like a very distressing moment for me.
As I read that, I thought I can absolutely imagine that moment, actually. So, I mean, for people who don't know, Black Mirror, UK TV series, and each episode was a sort of dystopian extrapolation of tech kind of now and what might happen if it continues on this path in the future. And so, for a client to then go, oh yeah, that sounds like a great idea, is worrying, indeed.
It was like a dystopian moment in and of itself. It's like, it's a moment from another show, which is Silicon Valley, I don't know if anyone's seen, but it's definitely like a parody of the tech industry in San Francisco.
So this would have been like 2015, 16, probably then when this was going on. The reason why I asked is because I definitely have seen, so, as you know, I've been involved in service design for a while, and I was the book we wrote is 10 years old, actually.
Amazing. Oh, my God.
Kind of probably around now-ish, I think. Yeah. I mean, it took us ages to write. So we started writing it at the end of 2010. And I think by then I definitely had already sort of discovered and got into systems thinking. But the first sort of few years of, before that, when I was shifting from, I'd say, sort of interaction design into that area, and I was interested in design of organizations and stuff, you know, there's a lot of, we're thinking a lot about the kind of zooming in and out. You'd think a lot about how an individual touch point sort of affects the whole system and how a shift in the whole ecosystem ripples across all the touch points and all of that. And then when I started, I think I read Donella Meadows's Thinking in Systems book, and I was like, oh my God, you know, there's this whole thing. And obviously, I don't know when, do you know where the origins of it? Because I mean, I trace it with her back to the limits to growth. But I'm guessing systems thinking goes back further than that.
Yeah. I wasn't actually super aware of the history of systems thinking methodology until I really started conducting the research in this book, even though I had come across some of the writings before. So for example, Peter Senge's The Fifth Discipline is kind of like a classic in organizational change management and systems thinking. And there's a lot of, I guess like thought leadership and writing from like the 1960s and 1970s, yeah. Specifically Peter Checkland kind of like wrote, I think the Systems of Systems methodology, I think it's called SSM.
That's the sort of the meta systems analysis of systems, right? Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Like soft systems thinking versus hard systems thinking. Mm. And I write a little bit about that in the book because I think there is, and I don't want to get like too deep into like the history of systems thinking because I think it's one of the factors that make this area really intimidating for designers is that they feel like it is like a fully fledged, you know, tradition. And if they haven't engaged in it at all or don't know anything about it, then they're not equipped to actually be doing systems thinking. Mm. And I've felt that barrier definitely. Like when I've kind of talked to folks who have used systems thinking, you know, in terms of like the formalized systems thinking practice, I would just like walk away from some of those conversations just feeling like I'm not equipped to be doing this. Okay. Like I'm not equipped to be creating systems maps that are dynamic and that, you know, I have to kind of plug in math.
Yeah, and there's a living flow diagrams of
right. Know, yeah. Yeah, living causal loop diagram. Yeah, yeah. Like, yeah, it's I think it can be a barrier. And then sometimes those in the design practice are like, you know, I have other things to do.
That's why I became a designer. I don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
The reason why I ask is because I think about, I was trying to think, probably 7-8 years ago, started kind of seeing more around systems thinking in design and, you know, and then it sort of crept in. And then, well, there was a bunch of stuff, and you write about something, some of this in the book as well, which was, you know, you just talked about the election, then we saw the whole kind of big tech, you know, the Cambridge Analytica scandal, and, you know, there was a whole lot of stuff around data.
Yeah.
And then this idea of, you know, what's going on in the tech industry and all the kind of potential harms, and also what happens if you sort of move fast and break things at kind of massive scale. Plus, then you got the Black Lives Matter movement, which had obviously been going for a while, but it hadn't had that kind of moment with George Floyd and is hopefully still going with their moment. I don't want to kind of make that sound like that was a blip. But there was a kind of, it was a moment where that pushed into much more of a kind of mainstream consciousness at the same time as Trump and everyone else. And then COVID happened. Right? And for me, you know, I used to struggle to explain this relationship between the micro and the macro. And COVID was in a way a kind of a gift there. And you talk about it as an example in the book because it sort of is a thing that everyone experienced, I guess.
Yeah. It's interesting how all of a sudden you had kind of the media trying to explain systems during the beginning of COVID. Like just things like, why is there a toilet paper shortage? So that like sort of interaction of like the micro and the macro, like suddenly all of us were like semi-experts in logistics systems and supply chain problems because we were like, oh my gosh.
Feedback loops as well, yeah.
Yeah, and feedback loops, like why is this one thing, why is there a shortage in terms of like this one thing, but not with others? And yeah, just the idea that all of these things intersect. I talk a little bit in the book about the STEEP framework, for example, like sociocultural, technological, environmental, economic, and political. And everything you saw happening, like particularly when the pandemic started, had every single one of those elements evolve, whether you're looking at toilet paper shortages or whether you're looking at like mask mandates or what have you. There's like a human behavioral element combined with, you know, various like systems at play, infrastructure, policy, et cetera. And I think like that's when you hear people talking about like how systems work, how you know, we have these supply just in time, supply chains, et cetera. And this affects everything that we do. And I think just having an understanding of that, even if it's like hard to figure out, like, how can this integrate in my work, is sort of a mindset shift that has been happening, I think, more broadly. I never, like, outside of academia, heard the term systemic racism used in the mainstream until just a few years ago.
Yeah.
And even that sort of, like, perception is a fundamental shift in our collective mindsets that is oriented around kind of thinking about how things are interconnected.
Yeah, yeah. COVID was like the sort of the biggest demo of a wicked problem, you know, that you could have given the world. Right? And absolutely. At the same time, you mentioned the Ever Given getting stuck in the Panama Canal as well. And all these kind of things happened all at once. It was very fascinating. And one of the things that struck me about those things is that they made the invisible visible, right? We kind of all knew this idea of globalization and supply chains. And yeah, I kind of know that, you know, everything in my iPhone sort of comes from, you know, all over the world and it's assembled, but I don't really kind of get how that happens. And it wasn't until, you know, people said, oh, I can't buy a fridge because, you know, there's no microprocessors around at the moment and that kind of stuff, as well as obviously all the kind of effects that when you just adjust to 3 or 4 touch points, like social distancing, masks, and, you know, trying not to touch stuff, all of a sudden there's a whole load of things in the world that you can't do. I have sort of a photo of an ATM machine. And it's really rubbish. It's the someone in classic kind of, the business has been told to do something and they haven't actually given the people on the ground the tools to do it. Someone had just stuck like a kind of piece of paper over an ATM screen and it just said, you know, out of use due to COVID or something. Because they didn't want people touching the touch screen at the beginning. So one of the things that I think design is going to bring to this though is exactly that, right? Is making the invisible visible. But before we kind of get to the intersection of design and systems thinking, I feel like we've probably jumped ahead a bit. Maybe you can, I don't know if you're up for giving us a sort of potted definition of what is systems thinking? What are the sort of crucial bits to it?
Yeah, I describe systems thinking, I try to summarize it in sort of 3 key concepts. So essentially, well, first of all, I really do want to emphasize that it requires a mindset shift before you can kind of like dive into the tools and methods to kind of enact it in your work. And that mindset shift involves kind of thinking about 3 things, thinking about how things are interconnected, thinking about causality, and thinking about wholeness. And so, you know, if you think about just like a forest or like a tree root system, all of those things are interconnected. The trees are kind of talking to each other and what have you. There's also causality. So you have a whole system of like biodiversity that is dependent on those trees and how they grow and interact with each other. And then you have wholeness, like that's the entirety of the forest and kind of like the impact that it has on each other. And that wholeness piece, there are kind of boundaries to it. And you can kind of determine where those boundaries are. You can be talking about the entirety of the earth. You can be talking about the rainforest, you know, the Amazon rainforest. Like it just kind of depends on like where your sort of system of analysis has its boundaries. And so kind of thinking about things in those way automatically should expand your purview beyond just like what you're working on as a designer, like whether you're working as a designer on a product, whether you're like designing how services interact with each other, whether you're working on organizational change, like all of these things, these 3 aspects really matter is just like how things are interconnected. What's the wholeness in terms of like what you're analyzing? And then what's the causality? Like what happens beyond the direct benefit of use? Specifically, if you're designing products and services, what happens beyond the direct benefit of use?
Yeah, and so that idea of causal loops, well, there's a few sort of fundamentals of things like stocks and flows, but that maybe you can explain what stocks and flows and causal loops are, because I feel like they're kind of core terms and we get stuck without getting those sorted.
Yeah, it's funny because like folks who are like familiar with systems thinking really associate it. These are kind of like the most iconic sort of expressions of systems thinking are often causal loop diagrams and then stock and flow diagrams. So causal loop diagrams are basically just cause and effect loops that can either like indicate, you know, there's different terminology, like it could be a virtuous cycle. So just something that maintains itself. The classic example used in systems thinking is a thermostat. So if you have a thermostat set to room temperature and then the heat drops like inside the house, the thermostat will kick on. It'll hit the temperature that you've set and then it will turn off. And so this is a sort of sustainable loop because it, you know, it kind of maintains itself. You can have vicious cycles as well. So I think an example that I use in the book is around urban sprawl. So the idea that people buy more cars, so governments invest in more roads and car infrastructure, and then things get built farther apart. And so people buy more cars. And so this is what you might describe, you know, if you don't like cars, as a vicious cycle. And what you do when you're creating causal loop diagram is you combine that causal loop with other causal loops that might be adjacent or might intersect with it. And so a good example for the urban sprawl example is another causal loop that's like the downshift of public transportation. Yeah. As the result of like government investment in car infrastructure. And a lot of times this can, you know, you can have an expression of causal loops that's only two loops like that. You're almost like getting at root cause in that case, or you can have one that's hundreds of causal loops. Yeah. And it just kind of depends on how far you want to bring your analysis.
Yeah. And so, there's that complexity kind of building in there. And you mentioned the Peter Senge quote, which is something like, today's problems were yesterday's solutions. Is that the one, I think?
Yeah. To paraphrase, I think that's what it is today's problems were yesterday's solutions. And yeah, that's a core part of the mindset of systems thinking.
Well, now, there's also this idea when you were talking about the public transport thing, because obviously you then also talk about ride-sharing services like Lyft and Uber there to fill the gap or at least the kind of user experience gap of, right, you know, bad public transport, but in turn have then sort of decimated or at least made public transport worse as a result. Right. Yeah,
which is like, that's part of this analysis too, is to kind of like see what's actually happening. And you wouldn't hear that from the rideshare services. Like they basically say like, we're improving public transportation. And I think that's one of the things that I don't know that I emphasize in my book enough, is just kind of like using these various inputs in order to kind of like inform your understanding of a space. That means engaging with others who are experts, like within the system that you're analyzing, as well as, I don't know, using kind of like the data that's around you, even like publicly available data, et cetera, to be able to like understand the nuanced story of how the system works.
Yeah. I mean, I think you do talk about that actually quite, you know, really nicely in the book, which is this idea of once you kind of broaden your lens and look, you know, beyond the end user, and you look at this kind of bigger context in which it's happening, and then, you know, perhaps the context within that, if you do it well, you automatically include other stakeholders and experts, and not just, and you actually redefine stakeholders of, well, not redefine, but you expand the term to not just be, you know, the business stakeholders and, right, and the end users, but, you know, the city and, you know, other people who aren't directly, you know, certainly perhaps not involved in any decision-making in some cases, but are affected by it.
Yeah.
I've got a question for you, though, which is, you know, this is the thing that service designers have a kind of reputation for, trying to boil the ocean, right? And they get caught in that, up in that thing where you ladder this stuff up enough. And of course you end up, as you say, at a point where you go, well, you know, because capitalism, right? We, you know, everything is all connected together. All the stuff we're talking about with kind of global supply chains and everything, you kind of get to a point where it just becomes this, you know, this big, massive global problem that is kind of systemic to the way we live. How do you draw boundaries? And tell me about sort of how you might go about that. And then sort of the importance of deciding, you know, where does my work end? And you talk about sort of the work, the influence, and so on.
Yeah, that's such a good question, because one, it's kind of hard to answer, because I think it's sort of up to you and the stakeholders who are involved in the system in which you're analyzing to kind of determine where the boundaries are. And yeah, it could be, you could continue analyzing to the edge of the universe if you wanted to and had the time to do so. But I don't know necessarily, like there's a point where there isn't any utility anymore. And I think part of it is, one, emphasizing that you're not doing this in isolation. Like as a designer, you're not like creating a systems map with you and just like your design team or what have you, or like your business stakeholder. The idea is that you are drafting these in workshops with people who are experts in different parts of the system, whether they're lived experts and that they're affected by the system, or whether they're, let's say, academic experts who work in the space. I think a good example is I do a lot of work in education, and you could totally boil the ocean. Like you could be talking about like every possible facet and aspect of education. If you took the STEAP framework and applied it, it touches everything, right? Yeah. You could be talking about, you know, the workforce, et cetera. And I think it's important to engage like a really broad number of stakeholders. So I think an example that I use in the book is a project that I actually worked on, which is kind of thinking about the experience and the outcomes of multi-language learners in the school environment, right? Yeah. And there's a couple of inherent limits. There's like system boundaries already. One is like, okay, we're limited to kind of thinking about how this can shift in the US. So we're not looking at like kind of like the international system of like an experience as a multilingual learners. You could do some comparison, like comparative study by engaging maybe like an academic expert who knows systems beyond the boundary of which you're drawing. And then, you know, we might limit it maybe to certain subjects because this is where we're thinking about the potential interventions in the space would fall within like these specific subjects or these specific school environment types or districts or what have you. And so the boundaries start naturally being drawn by, you know, there's this concept of bounded rationality. So when you come into systems analysis, you are bound by your own understanding, your own experiences, your own biases. And this is what Donella Meadows calls bounded rationality. And so everybody who comes into your systems analysis has something similar. So what's important is to engage people who have a different sense of bounded rationality. So I might engage, for example, subject matter experts who are academic researchers in understanding the dynamics of multilingual learners in their experience in K-12 education. And I think that's like a boundary like that I don't have as a designer, or, you know, knowing that I'm not necessarily a domain expert, I'm an expert in experience design. I don't necessarily bring that to the table. And I think by conducting this analysis with your sort of broad set of stakeholders will determine the boundaries of the system that you're trying to analyze. And I know that's not necessarily such like a satisfying answer, but I know when I've run into the problem of like not knowing where the boundary is when I'm trying to create a systems map on my own. Mm. That's the only time where I'm kind of like, oh my gosh, I can keep going and I can keep going and I can keep going. Your other stakeholders who kind of know about the system and who are affected by it will help you better understand where the boundaries are.
Yeah. In the Donella Meadows book, she uses these sort of clouds at either end of a sort of stocks and flows diagram to indicate that, yeah, we know there's other stuff here. And of course, kind of really, you know, one end wraps around to the other quite often as well. But this is the boundaries of what we're concentrating on. There was a thing that really stuck with me that Ben and Lavrens, with whom I wrote the service design book, and I think it was a live work thing, they used to talk about on and off ramps and this idea that each touch point has an on and an off ramp. So people are coming from, or step, are coming from somewhere and they're going somewhere else, whether it's from step to step or, you know, over time, or from touch point channel to something else. So, you know, coming from a website to a face-to-face experience. and this idea that if you can kind of take care of or consider the on and off ramp, and if everyone does it, then the whole thing becomes much more, if not seamless, then it's there's a lot more kind of joining together. Because a lot of the problem happens when, you know, one group of people design one bit, another group of people do another bit, and there's a gap. Mm-hmm. And everyone thinks it's the other person's responsibility. There's a lot here where you can imagine and think, well, you know, and this is, you know, there's a lot of designers who feel like, well, I want to make a positive impact in the world. I want to work on something to do with sustainability, social impact. There's this, you know, that I know lots of design students, certainly, but certainly lots of other colleagues who want to do that stuff and often don't get the chance to. I want to kind of turn it around, though, because that sort of siloed, disjointed kind of way of thinking that doesn't have those on and off ramps often happens in companies or in product teams where, you know, kind of cranking through a set of features from a backlog, and they're not, or the feature teams are separated from each other, but they're actually working on one whole thing, holistic thing. And from a, say, a product manager point of view, or from a CEO or business point of view, they're, you know, what's in it for them to think in terms of systems? Because I can see the counter argument is, yeah, that's all very well, but, you know, can't boil the ocean. So anyway, I've got this KPI or OKR, if you're lucky, to deliver this feature, right? Why should I bother with this?
Yeah, I think it's actually, I kind of describe it as a potential source of innovation. Like for people who are decision makers, if you understand kind of the system in which you're operating, you might be able to identify other points of, you know, I use the term intervention. I know it sounds weird in a business context, but like you can identify just other areas for potential change that could be not something that was on your radar before. And so I think that's like kind of one way of thinking about it. I think another is you might be able to identify potential unintended consequences if you kind of look at the system of like how you're designing something. So again, kind of back to the example of education, there are a lot of stakeholders in education. And if, for example, I'm working on a learning management system that needs to be used, I don't know, in a huge school district-wide, oftentimes, you know, the way you're designing it might be oriented around just, it might even be oriented around how, who is buying it, right? Like, yeah. There's the like, administrators, IT management,
not the end users.
Or what have you.
Yeah,
not even necessarily the end users. Yeah. And so you see a lot of failed enterprise products like that going into organizations, and then like the end users just like don't even bother with something because they're just like, you know what, I'm going to go rogue and use my own thing. You see teachers do this all the time.
I used to have a little microsite for my stuff all the time.
Yeah. I've done it. As a teacher, I've done it as well. And so I think just having that basic understanding, and it's not just about even just like shifting towards your end users. It's about kind of like understanding how you can kind of pave the way for success for a, you know, a certain solution or what have you. I remember, you know, I do a lot of work with like philanthropies as well. And I remember somebody telling me like, yeah, in global health, there are these philanthropies and like a lot of them have like just like there's going to be like a room in their office that's filled with like some failed interventions or failed products or whatever because they hadn't actually kind of thought about the adoption of these things within communities that, you know, they weren't familiar with or they didn't have any representation on their team or what have you to kind of talk about like what the boundaries are. I think I might talk a little bit about like the one laptop per child initiative from like the 2000s. Yeah. And that like lacked sort of like a systems understanding of how it could potentially be adopted. And, you know, some of the potential cultural barriers, some of the economic barriers and infrastructure barriers to that sort of thing being adopted, they might have come up with a different type of solution had they kind of understood the dynamics within the communities in which they were going to be operating.
And that was that this idea of kind of one laptop per child, that this thing would to just benefit one child didn't make sense culturally. That it would be, you know, how does this benefit the family or community?
Yeah.
There were similar things in Australia, I think, as well with the Indigenous community there, that some of the welfare systems that the account or the security is connected to, you know, log in by phone, and you have an app from the government that is like a, you know, two-factor thing. And the problem is it's matched to the IME number of the SIM card or of the device, and but those devices are shared. They're seen as a sort of common thing, and so it doesn't kind of work at all. Any of those things.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on.
Oh no, I was going to say, I think one of the things that I emphasize, and like, I don't think people typically associate this with systems thinking, though when I was doing my research, like some of the early kind of system scientists like Peter Checkland talked about it quite often, was, you know, what I call designer positionality. So thinking about who you are, where you're from, the kind of privileges you might have, the biases you have, and how that informs the way you think about solutions. And so I think many of these examples stem from not understanding even those who are going to be your end users, right? And so, like, I think there's that aspect of like understanding yourself as not being outside of the system, but within the system, is like kind of a core aspect of like the mindset of systems thinking, I think.
So, you know, designers, and you talk about this a bit, sort of often go quickly into the solution and solutionism and techno-solutionism in particular. But what's the difference between an intervention and a solution?
Yeah, so I try to avoid the term solution now because of that Peter Senge quote, which is like, you know, it's going to cause problems in the future. Yeah. So oftentimes I describe our way of like problem quote solving is more, like, I think it's problem navigating, right? Like, we're navigating problem spaces, especially when we're dealing with these big sort of like systemic issues. And it doesn't have to just be like a wicked problem in the social impact space. It can just be like, it could be a wicked problem in terms of like you're designing complex enterprise software or something like that. And knowing that there isn't like any sort of like singular solution keeps you from talking about things as solutions. And I think they're interventions because they create a shift in how you make change, right? And like there's Donella Meadows, again, has this concept of multifinality, which is like there's going to be different potential ways of intervening within a problem. Like there's no singular way. There's no like magic bullet. Doing something. There's like no app for that. So I think, you know, oftentimes within the technology sector, we sometimes think about the things that we're designing as, oh, this is going to kind of like fix everything. Or, you know, I think it's like inherent in the way of thinking as kind of this TED talkization of like what we're working on, where it's kind of like, oh, there's going to be all of these benefits. And that makes it hard for us to kind of think about like the potential problems that something might cause and how we might actually also create interventions for like the thing that we're designing. So that happens a lot like in the space of emerging technology. I think we're kind of seeing like that sort of grappling happening right now, for example, with like large language learning models and AI and how they're going to have an impact on us. Yeah, for some people, it's really hard to see the downside of that. And for others, it's really hard to see like how this could possibly have any benefit that won't, you know, result in, AI taking over everything for us or whatever. And I think it's just like more nuanced than that. And that's maybe like where systems thinking comes in, and like a problem space like that, that is like really meaty and has a lot of potential outcomes.
Yeah. Donella Meadows has this, people will find if they Google it, of this 12 leverage points. And they're all the sort of different facets of like, you know, policy and stocks and flows. And, you know, and they're in sort of increasing order of effectiveness. You start off with something like the metrics or something. And you know, that's genuinely what politicians kind of nibble around at. And the very last one is basically kind of change the system completely. And it's this kind of interesting set of way of looking at it. But I think also with that comes this sort of multifinality thing comes this idea that you talk about quite a lot, which is this cyclical versus linear, that you never, it's never really kind of finished, right? When you're working with systems, you know, this is why I kind of hate the language of product in terms of that sort of industrial language about kind of shipping code and kind of shipping features and stuff, because it makes it sound like we've done, it's out there,
right,
on to the next one, and we don't have to kind of think about it anymore. Whereas, you know, obviously it's an ecosystem and you're just, you know, no one ships code anyway. I mean, I shipped code. I've put a CD-ROM on a, you know, into a courier's hand and it's gone off. But, you know, you upload it to someone's computer, right? Someone else's computer somewhere in the world, right? You know, deploy it. But it's it's this idea that you put a thing in the world, it's much more like kind of, you know, throwing some litter into the forest, right? And it's going to have an effect. And then it is this idea of this kind of linear thing done. And I think that's cyclicality, that's not a word, but that cyclical nature of things is, no, I think I've just done that classic Americanism thing of kind of turning a
cyclist.
Yeah. But that cyclical nature of it, I think, is an important thing for people to get their head around, as is incentives and metrics. You talk about perverse incentives. Tell me, what are they?
Yeah. So I talked a little bit like about unintended consequences in the book and how, oftentimes an interesting thing about a system is a system kind of behaves in a way that might be independent of what you hope the outcomes would be. Mm. And a good example of that is the classic, I think some folks have heard of the Cobra effect, which is a really great example of perverse incentives. In the book, I use like an actual like historical example where in colonial Vietnam, the French colonial government tried to eradicate rats by putting a bounty on rats and having people bring in dead rats so that they could know the rat population was going down. But as they progressed, more and more rats were turning up. So they were having piles upon piles of dead rats. And they were like, what is going on? This is like, statistically, this is not what should be happening. And what it turned out was because they were incentivizing it and paying people for the rat bodies, that there was rat farming going on just outside of the city and people would be bringing in the dead rats. And actually the rat population was increasing. And so that's a good example of perverse incentives in terms of just like people are being incentivized to do the thing that you're actually hoping they don't do, or that you're actually hoping the outcome would be the opposite. And that, I think that happens sometimes just like inadvertently. So I hear a lot, for example, I've done some work with like the big technology companies that have social media platforms. And I think a lot of people like working within those product teams, as I've worked in the space of like responsible design and helping these teams with like responsible design, is that they really struggle with the metrics within their own organization. So if ultimately the thing that you're being measured by is, for example, daily active users or monthly active users, and you actually think like users need to slow their activity down, or, you know, they need to maybe stop using your product for a while, this flies in the face of like the organizational KPIs, and it makes it impossible to kind of do anything that might challenge those metrics to begin with. And so I think a really good understanding of within the organization you're in, what are the incentives? What are the metrics? What is your manager measured by?
Yeah.
What are your executives measured by? Helps inform like the decisions that you make, and also gives you the ability to potentially challenge those metrics if you need to, in order to have better outcomes. And I think some sort of like doing that sort of analysis of like who your stakeholders are and what they are ostensibly incentivized by kind of helps you maybe kind of like arrive at ideas about what the metrics should be.
Yeah. It's the same as when, you know, lots of layoffs just before stock buybacks that bump the share price, that the executive gets their pay the CEO. I guess yeah. they're kind of paid based on that. Yeah, you talk about, you have a, I'd like to read out the list actually, because I think they're really good. You said, you know, whether the metrics align with your desired outcomes. You know, how is the success of the product of your work being measured? Does the way that success being measured align with your organization and stakeholders' desired outcomes? Does it align with your desired outcomes for society? And how are people in your organization incentivized to achieve the measure of success? And do they align with the desired outcomes? And, you know, do they have a clear connection to the desirable outcomes, or are people likely to cheat the system to achieve their own incentives? And I think it's such a great kind of list of sort of, well, a checklist or a kind of filter to really kind of pass things through to more critically analyze it, I think, and what people are doing. And, you know, when people talk about ethics, they often talk about sort of there's a right and there's a wrong, but ethics is obviously highly contextual and more nuanced and complex. But I think that set of values, I think people are often really what they're talking about is this seems to be a very good way, because you're not saying what people should or shouldn't do. You're just saying, do these align with your values or not? And I think it's a very good kind of checklist for people to kind of look through.
Yeah.
So look, we're coming up to time. I could go on talking about this for ages because I love this subject area, and it kind of really dovetails well with, you know, with service design too. But we come to the final question, which is, as you know, this podcast is named after Powers of Ten, the Rand Charles Eames film about the relative size of things in the universe. And so that relationship between those different zoom levels. So what one small thing is either overlooked or could be redesigned that would have an outsized effect on the world?
Yeah. It's funny because I felt like this is such a good question from a systems thinking perspective, because the point of systems thinking is connecting of those small things with the with the large things. I had all these like potential ways of answering this, but the thing that I think I've been thinking quite a bit about that I'm not it's not a thing or anything that's designed, but you know, I've been thinking about trees, and I actually have an example in the book about like how some neighborhoods have more trees than others. And I was thinking about like, just like the impact, like if we all planted trees in places where there were not trees, what kind of difference that would make from like a temperature, like a micro temperature perspective. Mm. Like literally during heat waves, you have some neighborhoods that are, you know, 20 degrees hotter than other neighborhoods simply because they don't have foliage. So it's like, how can you have an impact kind of in a small way? And that might just be like, be a tree planting activist and go to those neighborhoods.
Well, then that's a great one. I mean, because it connects to so many other things. Because in the book, actually, you talk about how in LA, trees were removed from lower socioeconomic, predominantly black neighborhoods so that the police helicopters could more easily spot people from crime from above. And yeah. So there's a whole bunch of societal problems and biases and structural issues within all that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, well, it's also a thing that, you know, the wealthier people are, the more they can afford to have a piece of land that, you know, isn't built upon and rented out and so forth. That's a great one. I'm a big fan of trees. But yeah, thank you. Well, congratulations on getting your one out.
So you can find me on LinkedIn, just Cheryl Kababa. I'm the only one there with that name. So you can ask me questions up there, connect with me up there, follow me. I'm also on Twitter, though maybe a little less so lately in terms of, you know, checking it or what have you. Yeah, you can. I know. It's like, I feel like I'm just watching this community just sort of slowly fizzle out. But, you know, if you're up there, yeah, you can find me there. I'll get a notification.
You on Mastodon anywhere?
I am not on Mastodon.
Oh, come on. Get
it. I honestly, I've been having this debate with myself. Do I need another, like, should I just not do it?
Well, it's probably also not bad. But it's nice. At least I found it quite good. I'm a middle-aged white guy, so it's easy for me to say because I know there's people have been not finding it so comfortable. But I think if you find the right place, it's a, it reminded me of Twitter in the early days, and it was sort of quite nice.
Yeah. I'll admit I have lurked a little bit, and that has like I don't know. Maybe you'll push me over the edge by talking.
Okay, all right. So Twitter, I'll put a link to the book, to LinkedIn, and put it all in the show notes. Thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
Yeah, thank you so much. This has been a really great conversation. And also congratulations on the anniversary of your book. It's a classic. Thank you.
You've been listening to me, Andy Pollane, on Power of 10. You can find me at apollane on pkm.social on Mastodon, apollane on Twitter, or go to pollane.com where you can find more episodes, check out my coaching practice and online courses, as well as sign up for my newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to give it a rating on iTunes. As you know, it tickles the algorithms and helps more people find the podcast. As always, get in touch if you have any comments, feedback, or suggestions for guests. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening and see you next time. Thank you.